Listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Solar-powered, people-powered, soul-powered community radio. And this is Writer's Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host, Chemaine Montana.
Good afternoon, everyone.
We're having an exciting day today, aren't we, Chemaine?
Yes.
Our guest last week was Dr. Stephen Covey, the author of The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, and he spoke here in Fairfield this morning, and we got the opportunity to not only listen to him along with hundreds of other people, but also to meet him in person.
Yeah, and the whole town is abuzz about it. I went out to lunch, and everyone's talking. And there was standing room only in the Sondheim Center, which I think is for the first time.
It was an amazing presentation. This is a 77-year-old man with 9 kids, 51 grandchildren, and a lifetime gathering really spiritual knowledge and then imparting it into the business world. And quite an inspiration. Yeah. And you can listen to our interview with Dr. Stephen Covey at
writersvoices.com
and also
KRUUFM.com.
Great. And we have another very exciting and inspiring guest with us today because, and I say this because I have known of this writer for quite a few years. In fact, she teaches at the University of Iowa Summer Writing Festival, and although I have never taken her class, I actually try to schedule a class when she's going to be there so that I get to hear her speak at the 11s, the lectures that they have every morning at 11 and do the reading and so forth, because I find her a very inspiring writer and author. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Hope.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So this is Hope Edelman, the author of The Possibility of Everything, which a memoir that we both really enjoyed. I just poured through it thoroughly. Hope Edelman is the author of 5 nonfiction books, including the international bestseller Motherless Daughters. A graduate of the University of Iowa's nonfiction writing program, she has published articles, essays, and reviews in numerous magazines and anthologies. She lives in Topanga, California, with her husband and 2 daughters. So, Hope, can you give us a little synopsis of what this memoir is about?
Oh, I can try. It is Publishers Weekly described it as difficult to categorize, but they meant that in a good way, because story of a spiritual journey, it's a story of a parenting journey, it's a story of a marriage, but to me mostly it's a spiritual journey insofar that what began this trek that we took as a very hard-edged, cynical, intellectual New Yorker, and wound up following my husband's lead, going down to Belize to find indigenous healers to help rid our 3-year-old daughter of her aggressive imaginary friend, which is not something that I would have come up with on my own. I was not a very likely candidate for making this trip, but it wound up completely changing our lives and saving our marriage, too, which was under a great deal of stress at that point because of my husband's really long work hours in the dot-com age.
Now, tell us a little bit more about the imaginary friend. He's quite an important character in the story.
He is. It's funny that one of my most important secondary characters is actually an imaginary friend, or someone that we couldn't see, or that certainly I couldn't hear, though my daughter claimed that she could. We were living in Topanga, just a regular, you know, sort of family life, although my husband was doing those long hours. And one day my daughter ran into the office when I was on the computer and hit me really, really hard in the thigh without any provocation, much harder than you would think a 3-year-old could hit an adult. And in fact, she bruised me pretty badly. And when I followed her into her bedroom to ask what was going on, she broke down in sobs and said, "I didn't want to do it. Dodo made me do it." And I thought, what? It became clear, you know, after questioning her a little bit, that she had an imaginary friend. He had taken up residence in our house a few days earlier, I'm not really sure, but he became very omnipresent in her life. Over the next couple of weeks, she became very absorbed in talking to him, in referring to him, in blaming him for a lot of her behaviors. Now, this in and of itself is not really considered extraordinary. Lots of 3-year-olds have imaginary friends. They blame them for doing bad things. They talk to them, sometimes in a language that parents can't understand. But there was something that, right from the start, that did not feel right about this. In fact, it felt a little creepy. And her preschool teacher and her pediatrician and a therapist I consulted with later on all told me the same thing. It's a normal developmental phase, and she'll grow out of it. And I believed that for a while, but instead of growing out of it, she seemed to be growing into it and becoming more and more absorbed in this character and his world, which then grew and became populated with many characters, boys and girls, bad ones, good ones. She could talk about the big cold island that they lived on in extraordinary and articulate detail. Again, not the kind of typical three-year-old behavior you would expect. So At first I was just, you know, kind of concerned, and then over time I became actually troubled. And as we progressed toward this family vacation that we already had planned in Belize, we originally were going just because my husband's a diver and the second largest coral reef in the world is off the coast of Belize. It became clear to us as our departure date approached that we really needed to find some help for our daughter, and my husband was very interested in doing it through this alternative route. He had learned that there were healers down there that might be able to help, and so we went down there, you know, with that intent. By the time we left, we knew we needed to get some help for her because it was getting to the point where we were going to have to go to a psychiatrist and try to figure out what was going on, see how we could help her.
Now, your daughter also became physically ill.
She did. She had croup, and she was susceptible to croup, as lots of kids are. Every 6 months, she'd get the high fever and the seal bark cough. And she came down with it about 10 days before we were supposed to go on vacation. And I figured, okay, you know, it's usually a 7-8-day cycle, and maybe we'll still be able to go. But she started getting better and then just stopped, you know, like plateaued, and she still had this low-grade fever for days. So I brought her to the doctor, and the pediatrician said, you know, her ears are clear and it's a virus. She'll get better down there. I recommend that you go anyway. Don't lose the whole trip. Maybe the first 2 or 3 days, just take it easy while she's getting better and then enjoy your vacation. So on the pediatrician's recommendation, we went. But we had such an odyssey trying to get down there. What should have taken us 11 hours instead took us almost 2 days. And we had to spend a night in Guatemala, and then we had to get routed through San Salvador. And she became physically much sicker on the trip down, so that by the time we arrived in Belize, she was actually running a high fever. She really wasn't feeling well, and she wouldn't eat. She stopped eating, and in Guatemala, when I tried to give her the prescription medicine that the pediatrician had sent me with, she started thrashing on the bed, screaming and kicking that her imaginary friend didn't want her to take the medicine, and he didn't want her to get well. And that's when things really got scary for me, because I thought, oh boy, I'm in over my head here. I didn't know, do I go back to L.A.? Do I find a doctor in Guatemala? Do I go on to Belize? And at that point, I just made a purely practical executive decision. I thought, I'm closer to Belize than I am to Los Angeles right now. We have tickets to get to Belize tomorrow, and English is not spoken in Guatemala. My Spanish is passable, but not great. In Belize, everyone speaks English because it's the former British Honduras, so I'll find her a doctor there. But before I could ask about an M.D. in Belize City, my husband stepped in and started asking about traditional healers. So we were brought, the very day we arrived, we were brought to a bush doctor, which is what the Belizeans call their local shamans. We were brought to a bush doctor in the rainforest of western Belize in his little Mayan village. We were brought to his cabin, and he was the first person that we saw and asked for help.
And that was a very dramatic event, if I recall.
Really out of context for me, and I don't think we did a very good job of explaining what we were there for, and I don't think he completely understood our situation. He did the very best he could, and he did exactly what he was supposed to do based on his own training, but to me it just looked really frightening and exotic, and I wound up, in fact, grabbing my daughter and running out of the cabin because I didn't feel that I was really being very responsible as a mother by subjecting her to the treatment, which in fact was almost nothing. I mean, he just touched her wrist and said some prayers.
But crazy. It was her reaction.
Touched her really crazy, and I didn't want to subject her to that kind of emotional distress, so I cut the treatment short.
Now, did this? You know, I don't want to give away the whole story.
Yeah.
But
I understand.
Tell us how your trip changed your worldview.
Okay. And I don't want to give away the ending either, not because I want your readers to all, or your listeners to all run out and read the book, but because the people who have read it told me it's such a great surprise at the end that I wouldn't want to ruin it for anyone who wants to learn the story. Well, I went down there, you know, thinking that this is all a bunch of bunk and that I'm going to disprove my husband wrong when we go find these healers and nothing will happen, right? That's what I expected because it wasn't scientifically proven that they could actually help my daughter. Because what we were really bringing her for, even though physically she was sick, is we were in search of spiritual healing for her because the Mayans believe that if you're having physical ailments, and clearly if you're talking to someone that other people can't see, you need spiritual treatment. And I didn't really think it would help, but my marriage was really on the rocks. My husband so strongly believed that this was something to pursue. And I went down there because I felt if I refused to do it, things would get even worse in the marriage. And I didn't think it would hurt my daughter. I thought maybe it'll even be, you know, an interesting adventure, but in the end I'll be proven right. And that's not what happened at all. In fact, I was exposed to a completely different belief system, a different way of handling problems, especially with children. And I was the odd man out. You know, they laughed at me down there when I said it, you know, well, we'll have to go back and find a psychologist. The people that we met down there said, why on earth would you ever do that? Just go to the bush doctor. And I didn't think that, you know, it would be effective in the least, but I was completely proven wrong. It was, and it happened in ways that I never could have predicted or even imagined were possible.
Now, Hope, you mentioned that your husband was working, a co-founder, I believe, of a dot-com business, so which would imply that he would tend to have a scientific outlook on life or perspective. What is it about, why do you think he was so open to these alternative possibilities?
Well, he's always been alternatively minded, and he's on the marketing and not the tech side of the dot-com or of the company that he started. So he's more of the idea person, and he's always thinking out of the box, and he's always looking for connections that don't quite add up. And I think in many ways, modern science to him hasn't provided him with all the answers that he's looking for. So when I first met him, then this would be, you know, almost 15 years ago, he was already having a lot of different ideas that were different that from other people, and that's helped him a lot as an entrepreneur, but it also has made him very alternatively minded in terms of medicine and health and healing. So he would naturally pursue an alternative option first, whereas I was much more likely to go the very scientific route. And also, I guess my husband had a greater sense of faith and trust in the world than I did, which is a big part of my story in the book, because when my mother died, I was 17 years old, and I completely shut down any belief in anything larger than myself. I thought, you know, there is no God, or whatever you choose to call it, because if there were, my mother would never have been forced to suffer the way she did, and three children would not have been left without a mother. So I didn't have a sense of faith in anything larger than myself, and I didn't have a sense of trust that I would be taken care of in the world, except through the result of my own efforts, which had made me, honestly, a bit of a control freak as an adult, because I felt like I always have to be hyper-vigilant to keep something bad from happening again. And I wasn't really open to the idea that maybe things would just sort of take care of themselves or work out. I felt that it was only through, you know, hard work and the sweat of my own brow that good things would happen. So I certainly learned how to release some of that through the experience that we had in Belize, and then integrating it into my daily life, after integrating that new belief system into my daily life when we got back.
Your title is The Possibility of Everything, so you kind of came to believe more in the possibilities.
Well, actually, the title comes from a conversation I had with my husband before we left California, where we live, where he asked me what I believe in, and I didn't really know what I believed in, but I knew I believed in potential. I knew I believed in possibility. The door was at least open that much of a crack for me, and I think if it hadn't been open that crack, I never would have made the trip to Belize. I wouldn't have been willing even to try it. So I was always open to possibility, but it was certainty, you know, that I couldn't get quite a grasp on, or faith, really, that I didn't have much of at the beginning of the story.
Mm-hmm. Did it take a while for you to identify that phrase as the perfect title for your book?
I wish I could take credit for it, but no, it was a woman in my a writing group where I started the book who read a very, very early draft of that chapter and isolated that sentence fragment or that phrase, and she said, that's your title right there, that's your title, that encapsulates your whole book. And
yeah, it does.
You're right.
Yeah.
Now, Hope, this book is a little different than your previous work. Most of your previous work, although it combines some elements of your personal experience, also involved research and telling other people's stories as well. So what made you decide to write a memoir?
Well, I think I'd always hoped to write a memoir. This is the kind of writing that I studied in graduate school in Iowa, and what I had always imagined I would be doing, meaning a book-length narrative. But while I was in Iowa, I got the idea to write Motherless Daughters, mostly out of frustration, because I needed the book and nobody else had written it. I didn't think that I had enough to say to write it as a memoir, really. And what I wanted was the research and the interviews with other women. So I wrote the book, my first book, the way that I would have liked to have read that book had someone else written it. And then I just became fluent and became known for writing those kinds of reported memoirs, so I did a couple more of them. But when I wanted to tell this story, I actually first started it as a novel because it's such a wacky story. I didn't believe that anyone would accept that it had really happened. And I also was really concerned about my reputation as a fiction writer coming out with a memoir about a spiritual journey where things happen that can't be proven or, you know, easily explained. But in that writing group where the woman chose the title, I was workshopping the pages as a novel, and it wasn't happening, you know. People were not that engaged with the material. They were actually having trouble believing that it really could happen, which was kind of funny because I was writing it as fiction, right? So anything can happen in fiction, but the members of the group were having trouble believing that it could really happen. And one day, you know, just out of desperation, because I didn't have much time left to work on the pages and I didn't know what else to do for them, and I had to hand them in to my group for discussion, I just switched the pronouns. I thought, well, let me see what happens if I just try it as a memoir. Let's see. And I switched the third-person pronouns to the first person. That's all I did. And I gave the pages back to the group, and they read it and said, oh, my God, what did you do to this story? This is a completely different book. What did you change? So all I did was, you know, search and replace with the pronouns, honestly. But it had a kind of energy and an urgency to it as a real story. And then they had, interestingly enough to me, they had no problem believing it as a memoir. They were having trouble believing its veracity as a novel.
So
I thought, well, you know, I guess I'll try it as a memoir. And this is how I really want to write it anyway, which is probably why it wasn't working as a novel. And then once I started writing it as a memoir, it moved very fast. I'd been puttering around with it as a novel for like a year or a year and a half. And once I committed to writing it as a memoir, the writing then went very fast.
So, Hope, your group did not realize that it was actually a true story when you were doing it as a novel?
They knew that I'd taken my daughter to Belize to see a healer, but they didn't know how much of what they were reading which was actually true, which in fact was all of it, because I was just writing a memoir in the third person. And you know, that just doesn't work, because they're two different animals, a memoir and a novel. And I didn't really know how to write a novel. I was just trying to fictionalize my memoir. So, but I hadn't told them how much of it was real until I started giving them pages as a memoir, and then they saw that, in fact, almost everything I'd written had been real. But they were able to accept that it had all happened, you know, fairly easily. And I had I had some pretty serious skeptics in that group too. So I was relieved and pleased to see that the story was being told in a way where they could at least accept not that they believed it, but that the character believed it and that it had really happened.
Well, that's not surprising to me because, like they say, truth is stranger than fiction. Mm-hmm. And as a fiction writer, I think you can't sometimes go as far outside of people's expectations as what we really experience in daily life, or not daily life, but in our more adventurous aspects.
Right,
of
unless
life.
You say from the start, I'm writing surrealist fiction or I'm writing magical realism.
Right.
And there is an element, I think, of magical realism in my story, but it's a true story. And I think but I think there's an element of magical realism in real life, too. I think many of us experience it. We just don't know how to talk about it or explain it or put it in a context that other people can really understand.
I agree. And I think that this book is actually a maybe going to open some doors for people in being able to talk about it.
I hope so. That's why I ultimately decided to take the risk and publish it. But I have to say, you know, that the response has been really really positive. I think maybe it's just, you know, a certain time in cultural consciousness when people are more willing to accept these stories, or maybe have started to have similar experiences of their own that they're more willing to talk about.
I noticed you also wrote in present tense, which I understand is a little tricky to do, but the present tense gives it a real urgency or immediacy. Mm-hmm. Did that decision come along with at the same time as deciding to change the pronouns?
It came a little bit after. I actually had started it in the past tense, but I found that it was important for readers to take the journey with me from skeptic to someone who is more open-minded. Mm-hmm. The book just didn't read the way I wanted it to when I was writing it from the position of already having had the experience. I needed to go in there and re-inhabit my younger self, try to get back into the mindset of who I was at the beginning of the book or the beginning of the story, and then tell the story from her point of view. To me, that was mm-hmm. a more interesting way to write it, and I thought it would be a more interesting way to read it, to feel that, or for readers to feel that they were discovering the story, that the story was unfolding in real time as it did for me when I actually was in Belize, than to feel that they were reading the story told by someone who already knew how it ended.
Mm-hmm. You kept a journal while you were in Belize. Did you think at the time that you might turn this into a book?
No, I had no, because I didn't know how the story was going to end. And
right.
I went down, the only agenda I had when I went down there was to help my daughter, not to get a good story out of it.
Right.
So I had a journal with me, but it was a travel journal, you know, the kind of journal you keep when you're traveling and you want to, like, write down the names and addresses of the people you meet on the road kind of
yeah.
journal. So I was, like, drawing pictures of the palm trees that I thought were pretty. And the only part of my journal that wound up, or actually there were two parts of my journal that wound up being helpful. One was that I was so entranced by a lot of the geography and the physical details of the place that I did take notes. Just jotted down things that were of interest to me, like what the signs that were nailed to the side of houses said, and a lot of the old U.S. school buses are recycled down to Central America, so in Belize you'll see school buses with the names of the original U.S. school districts on the sides of them that haven't yet been painted over, so I was writing down, you know, Lincoln, Nebraska School District, Bayside, Texas, whatever. But the one scene that was really helpful for me from my journal was when we went to the first bush doctor's cabin. The next morning, I somehow understood that what had happened was really important, and I wrote that entire scene with all the detail and all the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only scene from the entire week that I basically transcribed into my journal. But when I wrote the book, I was able to just lift it from my journal and put it in the book and then flesh it out a little bit. But most of it was already there from my journal.
Mm-hmm. Now, the parts that you didn't write about, did you have any trouble remembering when you went to write?
That was probably the hardest part of writing the book, was recreating that the week that we spent in Central America. It was really 10 days, but only the first six are covered in the book. I had to sit with my husband and go over the conversations and really try to, you know, comb through his memories and recreate the conversations that we had. I had told the story numerous times, so I had sort of cemented it in my own mind, and there were snippets of conversations that I feel I really did remember verbatim over the years because I'd thought about them so much since they'd occurred. But I needed to go back down to Belize several times, in fact, to retrace the steps that we had taken from the airport to Western Belize, to San Antonio, to Tikal in Guatemala, back to Western Belize, down to the beach, all of that. So that if someone who really knew Belize read the book, they would be able to say, yes, this is an accurate depiction of the place and the people. That was really important to me because of my background as a journalist, that I get all of those tiny details right, which, you know, pose some challenges because some of the places that I wrote about simply aren't there anymore. Like in Placencia at the beach, the year after we were there, a very big hurricane came ashore, right, in Placencia, and many of the places that I talk about in the book were destroyed and haven't been rebuilt.
Mm.
So then I was on the internet, you know, looking at other people's family vacation photos from 10 years ago, looking for the places that I remembered but hadn't taken photographs of myself, because although we had a camera with us, it was not digital yet. This was the fall of 2000. So I didn't take a whole lot of pictures because you had to pay for everyone that got developed.
Right.
And so I have about 100 pictures, but they were just of things that were of interest to us as a family, not necessarily of details that I would want to use in a book.
Mm-hmm. So the events of the story occurred in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
When did you start writing about it?
I started writing about it in early 2002. By that time, we had another child, and she was an infant. And I used to drop my older daughter in preschool and then go for a drive until the baby fell asleep. And there was one cafe in Venice where I knew by the time I got there, she'd be in a deep enough sleep where I could take her out of the car and put her in the stroller and roll her in, and she'd sleep for an hour or an hour and a half. And so I started writing the book on my laptop in that cafe in Venice. And that would have been like the spring of 2002. It took me about a good 6 months after we got back to accept that what really happened had happened and to try to, you know, figure out how I felt about it. Then about 6 months later, I started writing it. But again, I started writing it as a novel. I worked on it as a novel for about a year, year and a half before I decided to do it as a memoir. And then I wrote about maybe 80 or 90 pages very quickly, but then I stopped to write Motherless Mothers, which was the prior book. And that absorbed me for a couple of years. And then I came back to this one and worked on it some more, got a book contract. So it took me 6 years to write the first 100 pages, just about. And then I wrote the rest of it, the next 200 pages, in 15 months to finish the whole rest of the book, the next 200 pages.
Hmm. Your longing for your mother kind of played a role in your travels and your searching in Belize. Can you talk about that?
I can. Well, you know, it wasn't supposed to when I started this book. I said to my agent, God, please, please, no more books about mother loss. I've done four. Enough. I really need to move on as a writer, but more so than as a writer, as a human, you know, as a woman, as a mother, I need to move on from this subject. And I also decided right from the start there would not be the word mother in the title, because all of my other books had the word mother in it once or twice. But as I was writing this book, I was about halfway in. I remember by that point I was under contract. I remember calling my editor and saying, oh, Marnie, I can't believe it, but guess what? My mom is part of this book. And he said to me, of course it is. I've known that all along. I've just been waiting for you to realize that. But I think it made the book much richer, because you can't write about being a mother without writing about not having a mother and having lost her. I think her absence, even more than her presence during my first 17 years, her absence at the time this story took place is a really important part of the story, because I didn't have her to call up and say, hey, do you remember my imaginary friend? Because I had one when I was three, and as I remember, she was a pretty big deal in our family. And my parents had really nurtured her as a piece of my imagination. But I didn't have, my father at that point said he couldn't remember. My mother, I think, would have remembered, but wasn't there to ask. So if I'd been able to say, hey, do you remember my imaginary friend? How did she appear? How did she disappear? How did you feel about it? What did you do? I think it's really possible my mom would have said, oh, it was really, you know, very interesting and charming, and we indulged you, and then she just went away. Don't worry about it. Don't do anything. And, you know, maybe I would have listened to her. Maybe I would have let her advice override my own intuition, which said you have a problem here and you need to do something about it. Although my imaginary friend, I think, was fairly positive. She was created as a companion, and she disappeared the week my sister was born, so I think I just created her to have someone to talk to, play with in the house, because I was the firstborn. Whereas my daughter's was really, you know, quite negative from the start. It really had a negative influence on her. So that wasn't my experience as a child, But, you know, again, if my mom had been there, maybe I would have just said, you know, I'll just wait and see what happens, and not have made that trip. And in a way, that would have been a shame, because it was an incredible adventure, and it really changed my family's life. And as I said, I really firmly believe it saved my marriage, because it brought my husband and I closer together on the spectrum of cynicism. You know, I was all the way off in one corner being skeptical, and he was pretty far out in the other direction. And I think as a result of having not just had this experience, but having done it in a way that I think was really careful and cautious and responsible as parents, we met somewhere in the middle.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica Hadley and Chimaine Montana, and our guest today is Hope Edelman, the author of The Possibility of Everything, a memoir, which, by the way, I did see this book at 21st Century here in town, so I know Tony has it, and you can order it from any of your local bookstores. And it's got a beautiful blue butterfly on the cover.
Right. Your book has the blue morpho butterfly. Is that what it's called?
Yes, it's the blue morpho. It's native to that area. Most people know it in Costa Rica, but there are blue morphos in Belize as well. And I love that as a symbol of transformation, but it's also a scene in the book when we go to the blue morpho butterfly farm and learn about the life cycle of the blue morpho. So it's out of the book, but it's also, I think, a terrific symbol for what I went through as a person, or, you know, as the narrator of this story.
Mm-hmm. Now, Hope, you talked about keeping a partial journal during this trip. Is journaling something that you do on a regular basis?
Sadly, it is not, and I wish it were, because there have been a number of times when I would have liked to go back and have notes. I did keep journals very extensively during my younger years, like throughout high school and college and a few years beyond, and I still have all of them, and I can go back and look up details. What I tend to do is I save all my calendars so I can go back and at least, you know, have a record of chronology.
Oh, that's a good idea.
What I've done or what we've done as a family. Now I blog. I don't blog that regularly right now because I've been so busy traveling, but I think blogging will probably take over as my form of journaling, as it has now, right, for thousands of people. Which it sort of brought a form of journaling back into, you know, common use.
Yeah.
I don't know how many people maybe have foregone paper and pen journal for blogs, but I know that there are people blogging who I don't think otherwise would be journaling.
Speaking of blogging, you're involved in lots of online marketing efforts, including some blogging and some social network working sites for books. Was that spearheaded by your publicist or your publisher?
Not really. It was... I was encouraged to do it by all the writers around me, because in today's publishing climate, it is not enough to be a writer anymore. You have to be a marketer. You have to be a blogger and a lecturer and a social networker and a website designer, and it's a lot more extensive than it was 15 years ago when I wrote my first book, when the publisher would send you out on a book tour and you'd get media and that would sell your book. Mm-hmm. It's a completely different world now. You have to tweet and blog and do Facebook and create pages, and then there are all these literary networking sites too, where readers will go to learn about you or your book. So I did most of that on my own, although the publisher has just set me up with a virtual book tour for the first 2 weeks of December, where I will be doing a lot of Q&As and some guest blog posting on many of the book blogs that are out there now, because that's become, you know, a very, very viable and important way to let readers know that your book is out there. And because of the niche marketing strategy, you're able to go right into the audience of people who might be most likely to be interested in your subject matter. But it's a lot of work. I have to say, I haven't started a new book yet, because the marketing for this one has been, you know, really time-consuming and absorbing. It's been wonderful. I don't think anyone really knows exactly how to use it yet. At least nobody that I know has you know, found the key to the kingdom. There are a couple people who've written marketing books who are probably much better at it than your average literary writer is. But I think we're all still finding our way right now. The whole publishing landscape is transforming and evolving so quickly, you know, almost in real time, that what we're doing today may not at all be relevant in another year or two. So I'm trying to keep that in perspective, not get too caught up in the online marketing, because it is going, I think it's going to be really different in another year or two, just as it was, you know, it was so different 2 years back. Like when I started writing this book, I just went into a cave and started writing and focused just on writing and Belize and Mayan history, because there's a lot of that in the book, learning about Mayan healing. I went down to Belize for a workshop. And then when I finished the book and sort of reemerged into the larger world, the whole landscape of publishing had changed. I didn't even know what Twitter was. I was so out of it. my sister said, "You have to get on Facebook, because all your high school friends are contacting me wanting to know where you are." I don't need that. I have a website. But, you know, I was wrong. Facebook has become a really, really important tool for marketing the book and letting people know when I'm coming to town and where my events are. And, you know, quite a few people show up at the events because they saw postings on Facebook.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I posted on Facebook about this interview.
This is and I will probably tweet a link to it if you've got it online.
I'll find you.
This is,
it comes full circle. Yeah.
This is the first time I've heard the term virtual book tour, though, so that's very interesting.
Yeah, how do you create a live event? Is that through a forum on a website?
I think so. I mean, most of the events on my virtual book tour are going to just be postings, like someone sends me a list of questions and I answer them online, email them back, and they get posted on somebody's blog.
Okay.
And then I just did a blog posting for bookreporter.com, which is where book clubs go, or book club leaders go to find books that they want to select for their group. So I don't know how many live events I'm doing on the virtual book tour. I think live chats, I'm not sure. I know that I'm encouraged to comment to the comments on my postings, but it's hard to keep it straight. You know, when you've got 10 or 12 interviews and blog postings up at one time, it's almost like I need to really have a good spreadsheet to know where I'm appearing when. I mean, really, basically, yeah. I'm just sitting at my kitchen table, right? But I'm simultaneously appearing on a dozen blogs, all, you know, on the internet, and need to be a presence on each of them all at the same time.
Yeah.
Are you doing any book readings via webcast?
Via webcast? I don't think so, actually. You mean like live streaming? That kind
yeah,
of thing?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, I've done quite a lot of book appearances and house appearances, but we haven't put any of them online at the same time. I think that, you know, that's the kind of thing I'd probably do in a year or two, but right now just trying to get a handle on everything else took up most of my time.
Wow. How much time do you actually spend when you're writing? What is your writing process? You say you go in a cave, but are you writing 8 hours a day? Are you writing, you know, mornings and then, you know, what's your writing process like?
Well, theoretically, I write when my kids are at school, now that they're both in school full time, and thank God we're done with half day kindergarten, which is death to the writing mother. We have to pick your kid up every day at, like, you know, 11:30. Mm. But I have those hours to write. But I'm a night writer. I do my best writing late at night. Mm. And when I'm working on a book, I tend to keep very strange hours. You know, I will do as much as I can while the kids are at school. Generally, I do my revising. But to generate original material, I do my best work after 9 o'clock at night. So typically, after they go to bed, I'll work until 1 or even 2 in the morning. Then, God help me, I get up at 6:30 or 6:15 mm-hmm. to get them off to school. I'll bring them to the bus stop, come home and sleep for a few hours, wake up and do the revisions, and then, you know, after they go to bed, write some more. So it's kind of a loopy schedule.
To say, do you get enough sleep?
I'm out of sorts. I can't do it for more than a week or two at a time like that because I get really upside down, you know, sleeping during the day and being up at night. Mm-hmm. It's a very inverted schedule, although I sleep in two shifts. I sleep, you know, 4 hours and then another, like, 3 hours during the day. That's when I'm on a really tight deadline and need to get it done. The rest of the time, you know, maybe I'll write from 9 to 11 at night and do some work during the day. I do a lot of work, or I get a lot done in binge writing weekends, which is what I call them, about every 4 or 6 weeks. I'll go check into a hotel up the coast, and my husband will watch the kids for a night or two, and I'll just write from the minute I get up till I go to bed at night, and that's when I just do all first draft work. It's just about getting the story down so that I can revise it then when I get home while they're in school. So I get a lot of original material out. I can get more generated in 2 or 3 days that way than I can probably in 2 weeks trying to work during the school hours.
Your schedule sounds like it takes a lot of self-discipline.
Actually, I'm not disciplined at all. I wish I were the kind of writer that could just get up at 5 in the morning, write for an hour or two, and then, you know, write from 9 to 3 while my kids are in school, day after day after day. I'd certainly be a more productive writer, but I don't think I'm, you know, inherently that structured. So I tend to work best when I'm under deadline, you know, when someone's lighting a fire under my seat. Then I can get things done quickly and I can get them done well. But the rest of the time, I'd much rather sit around reading a good book or answering my emails or conversing with my readers online. I really have to force
that's
myself
working
to
too.
Write during the day. I wish I could just stick to a very set schedule, but that's just not who I am or how I work.
Yeah.
Well, Hope, before we get too close to the end of the hour, we'd like to have you read a section from The Possibility of Everything.
Okay, I've chosen a section to share that comes close to the beginning of the book, and it is set in Topanga Canyon, California, where we live. The first three chapters of the book are in California, and I thought I would read a section right at the beginning of the Odyssey with my daughter that explains a bit to you about who I am and where my mind is at the beginning of the story. And
great.
It takes place in my daughter's, it starts in my daughter's bedroom when the imaginary friend has already appeared and I've just spoken with her preschool director.
Okay. This is Hope Edelman reading from The Possibility of Everything.
So what you need to know is that my daughter's name is Maya and my husband's name is Uzi. And her preschool teacher's name is Prima. You're going to hear all those names in this section. And I've just decided that I'm just going to ask my daughter about her imaginary friend to find out what's going on because I can't sort of get a handle on it otherwise. Okay. Maya, I asked that night as we're snuggled together in her bed reading The Red Balloon. What, she asks. At school today, Prima told me you're playing in the back corner of the play yard by yourself. Don't you want to play with the other kids? She shrugs. They play with me sometimes. When you go in the back by yourself, I ask, are you playing with Dodo? Sometimes yes, sometimes no, she says. She tries to extract a page from underneath my finger to move the story along. Maya, is Dodo made up or real? I ask. Icked up, she says. I exhale a small sigh of relief. That's what I thought, I tell her. Real, she says. Wait a minute, you just said he's made up. She manages to pull a page free and turn it over. The next one is a four-color photo of a young boy racing through the streets of Paris with a gang of little thugs in hot pursuit. I maked him up, so he's real, she says. So 3-year-old, isn't it? Later that night when I repeat the conversation for Uzi, he laughs out loud. You have to admit, he says, the kid has a point. He's right, it is a legitimate answer for a 3-year-old. Maya doesn't yet understand the distinction between animate and inanimate, between what's real and what's not. I can still remember the time in childhood when I hadn't figured it out either. Until age 8 or 9, I still believed wholeheartedly in the existence of fairies and ghosts, witches, elves, and booming voices descending from the clouds. The fact that I'd never actually seen or heard such phenomena didn't invalidate their existence. The absence of proof only fed my imagination, allowing me to believe that even more extraordinary possibilities might exist on the other side of an invisible border. It wasn't hard to hold 2 simultaneous worlds inside my head, one I could see and one I couldn't, but both were equally real to me. As a second grader, I believed, no, I knew, that flowers felt pain when I pulled them from the ground, thus requiring a spoken apology, and that my Springer Spaniel could read my mind. It didn't hurt that this was an era when American interest in psychic and occult phenomena was at an all-time peak. The Exorcist was one of the highest-grossing films of the decade. Small planes were disappearing over the Bermuda Triangle with unprecedented frequency. And in our kitchen, my mother placed a metal spoon in front of the television set to see if Uri Geller could bend it with his mind. My father was a man of simple and straightforward facts, but my mother possessed a secret, unconventional streak. I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 10. Can you guess what it is? She'd ask me, apropos of nothing in the car, a spontaneous psychic pop quiz. In 1981, we sat in the paneled wood basement of our house together to watch the chain-smoking, antagonistic Tom Snyder conduct an hour-long prison interview with the raving mad Charles Manson. I was riveted by the way Manson's rambling, circular non-answers were punctuated by random moments of unsettling clarity. He would mutter, how old am I, forever, since breakfast, in one sentence, and then state, there's only one person you should be scared of, and that's yourself, in another. I didn't know how to reconcile such duality in a single human being. I'd never witnessed it to such a degree before. He's a total weirdo, was my assessment at the end. He, my mother said, is an example of a deranged and fascinating mind. By then I was 16, and whatever private connection I had once had to the mystical and unseen had long since shut down. It happened, as I recall, in a series of little deaths. I can still remember the horror, there is no other word for it, I felt at age 6, the day I learned that Mr. Rogers' trolley didn't come rolling into his living room on its own volition in response to his call, and the grief I felt upon discovering at age 8 that the Waltons were not a real family calling out good night to one another in the dark every night, with lives that continued uninterrupted after my television was turned off. By the time I turned 11, nearly all of my earlier beliefs had been replaced by the rational certainty of a budding adult. As I remember it, in the 4th grade, I was still anthropomorphizing my Snoopy doll, and the following year I was rolling my eyes in a Girl Scout meeting, when a Seneca woman read us her tribe's creation myth for our badge in Indian lore. Because, give me a break, everyone knew that crows couldn't talk. 13 months after the Manson interview, my mother was gone. A death that happened so fast it left all of us spinning without orbits for a very long time. In the first few weeks after she died, the sense of her presence was still so strong, I would wake up every morning expecting to see her and have to learn all over again that she had died. At night, alone in my bedroom, I would try to make contact with her. Mom, if you're out there, I would think, please send me a sign. If a car drove up our street right then and cast its lights through the window onto the wall above my bed, did that mean she'd heard me? For nearly a year after she died, I spontaneously woke every morning at 2:43 a.m., the exact minute of her death. Did that mean she was trying to send me a message? What was she trying to say? No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't break through the unseen barrier that kept her from me. And the weeks became months, which became years. And I graduated from high school and graduated from college and moved from New York to Chicago to Tennessee to Iowa to New York, fell in love and got a cat and fell in love again and learned how to bake lasagna, all without her knowing any of it. And over time I had to accept she was nowhere at all. In the 19 years that followed her death, I became a strict disciple of rational positivist thought, in which scientific rigor, the sacred triad of observation, experimentation, and proof, are the undisputed gold standard for determining what's real. Yet billions of other people on the globe find a way to integrate religious and spiritual beliefs that defy logical explanation into their mundane everyday lives. Maybe it's because everyday domestic life for most of us is so mundane that the mystical offers appeal, which would explain why, when Maya insists that she made up Dodo, therefore he's real, I feel a tiny flicker of hope for the possibility that I might be wrong when I arrogantly maintain that just because I can't see him, he cannot possibly exist.
Thank you, Hope. That was Hope Edelman reading from The Possibility of Everything, a memoir.
Hope, I love about your memoir that it's what I call searingly honest. I love your descriptions of yourself, not so much in this passage, but you mentioned earlier that this hypervigilance where and control freakishness. And I love the honesty with which you describe yourself. There's something healing to the reader in hearing someone else describe themselves so honestly.
That was very emotional to go back and do that because, like I said, I had to go back and get into the mindset of who I was back then, and mm-hmm. I was a really controlling person.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I was grateful for what I had. I think I was far more arrogant than I am today, mostly as a result of having had the experience in Belize and having written the book and gone back there so several times to get to know the people and the place better.
Was that hard to get into the mindset of your previous self? Was it hard to remember?
It wasn't hard to remember, but it was kind of embarrassing times, and a little bit shameful to have to say this is who I was and I embrace it. But I think through that process, I developed a great deal of compassion for my younger self. Mm-hmm. And that in and of itself was very healing.
Mm.
You also talk very intimately about your relationship with your husband. And I heard you give a lecture a couple years ago where you talk about some of the issues that come about when you're writing memoir and you're including other people. By necessity, other people's lives are included in your memoir and how it impacts the other person. How'd your husband feel about your writing about him and publishing this book? Were there any issues?
Well, he's a very private person, but he thought this was an important story with an important message and that trumped his own ego. He was a real champ about letting me write this book, letting me get so personal in the book. But at the same time, I did grant him veto power. I let him read the manuscript before I sent it to my editor and told him, let me know if there's anything in here that you don't want people to know. There was very little that he asked me to take out, just a few small details, and they were things I never would have dreamed, or imagined would have bothered him.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't really affect the story at all, so I just struck them right out of the manuscript because I didn't want to print anything that he would feel exposed him in a light that he didn't want to be exposed.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, he gave me full license to write about my own feelings, even when they were I think, you know, upsetting to him. It's not, how nice can it be to have your wife come out with a book where she talks about, you know, there was a time when she was seriously considering ending the marriage.
Yeah.
And taking the kid and moving out. You know, I write about that because it was true. It was authentic and honest. I really felt that I had been left to raise our child alone, even though he was, you know, nominally still there as the husband and the father, but he was never physically there at all. And it was hard for me to think about how he would feel reading that when I wrote it, but to not write it would have not been telling the whole story. It would have been inauthentic. So I, you know, sort of hunkered down and did it, and then, you know, stayed upstairs. He was kind of shaking as he was reading the manuscript downstairs, but he was really very, very generous, I think, with his own story insofar that he let me publish my version of events, even when they didn't necessarily correspond with his version of events. I'm sure if he wrote a copy of this book, he would have a lot more to say about how controlling he felt I was at that time. Domineering. But at the same time, you know, this happens in a lot of families when the wife is and the mother is responsible for 95% of the household and the child care. She does have a certain, out of necessity, a certain amount of control over what goes on in the house because she's the one running the day-to-day show. Mm-hmm. And But I'm happy to say that he works far fewer hours now, and we share the responsibility much more equally, much more along the lines of what I had hoped for and expected when we first came together as a couple. Since we're both working parents, he really does much more of the domestic tasks than he did back when I was telling the story. But part of that was a result, I think, of also having gone down there and had the experience together as a family. It drew us all closer together.
Mm-hmm. Now, Hope, you told a similar story about your father's reaction. I think it might have been to your first book.
Well, you have a good memory. You must have been at that lecture I did on writing about real people.
Yes, I was. And I can you share that story? I love that. It's just a wonderful story.
Well, the fifth chapter of Motherless Daughters in the first edition began with, "There's no way I can write this chapter without hurting my father," because I knew that I had so much trouble writing that chapter. I knew my father was going to have a very hard time with the book as a whole, but certainly with me writing anything about my relationship with him, which at that time was very distant because he would not talk about losing his wife. And he just couldn't emotionally go there. And so when I finished that manuscript, I sent him the book, the whole book, and I sent it to him strategically at a point where we could still make small changes, but I couldn't make big changes, like I couldn't take out a whole chapter, for example. Hmm. And I sent it to him, and I called him up, you know, about a week later, and I said, "Did you read the book?" And he said, "Yep." And I said, and what do you think?" And he said, "Devastated." And I thought, oh, this conversation is not turning out very well, is it? And I said, "Well, you know, if there's anything in the book that's factually incorrect, let me know, and I will take it out. If there's anything that you remember, you know, differently or anything that's not correct." And he said, "Well, I bought your mother that fur coat. She didn't inherit it from my mother." That was it. You know, the whole book, that's all. That was factually incorrect. So then I knew what he was upsetting him was not that I had gotten things wrong, so to speak, but that I had written about things that he either didn't want to talk about or didn't want other people to know. And I think he was really concerned that the family members would circle the wagons and point their finger at him and say, "You were a terrible parent. You did not take care of your children." When, in fact, the opposite occurred. The family members called him and said, "We are so sorry that we weren't there for you. We had no idea how hard it was for you." And I think then he felt kind of validated, and then he became the biggest champion of the book, and he would start going into Barnes & Nobles all over New York City and insisting that they put it in the window because it's his daughter who wrote it. It was very sweet, very supportive at that time, and it changed our relationship completely, and he did start talking more about losing my mom and the choices that he had made and how he had felt and even how he was still grieving all those years later. So I think it opened up a new chapter in his own grieving as well as helping to heal the relationship he had with his children, because we obviously all knew that something enormous and life-altering had happened in our family, but when you don't talk about it, what happens is that the children develop a sense of shame around it. So I walked around for years feeling ashamed that my mother had died. There was nothing to be ashamed of, but I experienced it as something shameful because nobody would talk about it with me.
Wow. Yeah. Well, it sounds like in your experience writing authentically, writing your truth can be scary but has very positive results.
It can, but not all the time. I mean, it also can upset people very greatly and alienate them. And that's happened to me, and it's happened to many memoirists I know and many of my memoir students. Because what you find is that what to me is a truth, to somebody else is a secret, and then to somebody else, like I just described, is a shame. And so I try to tread lightly, but at the same time, I also, without wanting or ever intending to hurt anybody that I love, I do feel that I have to tell an authentic story, or else what's the point of doing this if I'm not writing something that's real and true, to me, at least.
How does Maya feel about being the star of this book?
Well, when she was 5 years old and I started it, or four and a half, I guess, when I started it, she just thought it was really, really cool that she was going to see her name so many times in a book. That's how, a 4.5-year-old thinks. She got older, she came to realize exactly what it would mean, and she's not so crazy about having her 3-year-old self written about, because she doesn't feel that she's really accountable for what happened when she was 3, and she's right. Mm-hmm. And now she's 12. She just turned 12. And she's not thrilled with there being a book about her out there, but like my father, she hasn't experienced anything negative. She was afraid that, people would make fun of her because she had an imaginary friend when she was 3. And again, the opposite has happened. People think that she was an enormously creative and imaginative child. So if anything, she's gotten positive feedback rather than negative. But she has made me promise that I will not write about her in my next book.
Now, what about your other daughter?
I have agreed to that because, of course, the parent-child relationship is more important than any book I could write. So that means I'm not doing a contemporary memoir next. I don't know what I'm doing next, but it won't be a book about Maya. That much I can promise her.
Well, Hope, when you do figure out what you're doing next, let us know so that we can have you back to talk about it.
Thank you. I'd love that.
That would be great. And we are out of time.
This has been a great conversation, Hope. Thank you so much.
Thank you both so much for all that you do on behalf of writers everywhere.
Thank you. And we'll see you on Facebook.
And hopefully I'll see you next summer in Iowa City.
Absolutely. I'll be there in July for 2 weeks.
Great. Great. Our guest next week will be Dr. David Daniels from the Stanford University Medical School. And his book is called The Essential Enneagram. And Shemaine and my mother, Caroline, will be hosting that show because I will be visiting my new baby grandson.
Congratulations, first-time grandma.
That's right.
And what's his name and how?
Logan Daniel.
And how big was he?
He's 7 pounds, 9 ounces, born Monday morning at 2:19 to my son and his wife. And we are out of time. So stay tuned if you're listening on Friday to Planet Earthwild with James Moore. And if you're listening Monday morning, stay tuned for the Best of Broadway. And we'll close with a quote that my mother told me at lunch, although she couldn't remember. She thinks she read it in this month's source, but it was something, may you always be happy and may your enemies know it.
That's a good one.
See you next week on Writer's Voices.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.